From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. You may not have heard of David Addington, but he's been described as the legal mind behind the White House's war on terror. He's also been described as Cheney's Cheney. Addington is the vice president's chief of staff and longtime legal advisor. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Jane Mayer of The New Yorker magazine about her profile of Addington called The Hidden Power. It examines his role in the Bush administration's expansion of executive authority. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead listens to the Ben Goldberg Quintet's new CD. It's a tribute to soprano saxophonist Steve Lacy, who died in 2004. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
This is fresh air.
This is fresh air.
David Addington has been described as the legal mind behind the White House's war on terror, the lawyer who's come up with the legal justifications for the expanded executive authority that's been claimed by the Bush administration in waging the war. Addington has also been described as Cheney's Cheney, or less charitably, as Cheney's hitman. He replaced Lawrence Scooter Libby as the vice president's chief of staff after Libby resigned last October. Before that, Addington was Cheney's legal counsel. My guest Jane Mayer profiled Addington in an article titled The Hidden Power, which was published in the July 3rd issue of The New Yorker. Before we talk about David Addington's role in expanding executive powers in the Bush administration, let's just get to last week's Supreme Court decision about Guantanamo. How does that decision begin to narrow some of the powers that the president has assumed in the war on terror?
Well, first off, it says that the president has to consult with Congress now in the way that it tries the detainees in Guantanamo. The president can't just make up his own rules for how those tribunals are going to work. The president instead has to pay attention to the rules that were already passed previously by Congress, which are for a court-martial, as it's set up under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So the president has to consult with Congress. Congress has to okay what the president's going to do in terms of trying detainees. And beyond that, and in many ways more importantly, the court says that the president has to obey the Geneva Conventions in the way it treats detainees, which that is exactly the opposite of what David Addington has told the president. David Addington told him they could just set these conventions aside.
In what way has David Addington been so key in defining and expanding presidential power, executive power, during the war on terror?
In his view, during times of war, the executive can pretty much override all other branches of government in terms of deciding how the war is conducted. And since this is a worldwide war, and it is a war without any sort of defined end, that gives the president pretty much unlimited power, as David Addington has defined it.
You write about David Addington as being Cheney's Cheney, the kind of the legal mind behind Cheney and part of the power behind Cheney. What is the vision that he and Cheney share of executive power?
Well, they're both great devotees of Alexander Hamilton's view that the president needs to be able to work with secrecy and dispatch and energy, and that a strong foreign policy requires a strong executive, unencumbered pretty much, as in certainly in the conduct of war, by Congress or the courts. So they both really want to try to build up the presidency, and some people see this as the new imperial presidency that they're trying to build.
You say that their views on executive power date back to the days of the Ford administration.
Yeah, it goes back years and years. I mean, in a way, it all begins for both of them with Vietnam. Both these guys were terrific hawks on the subject of Vietnam, and they felt that America could have won the war if Congress hadn't stopped America from fighting that war. They blame Congress for losing the war in Vietnam, and from stopping the president from fighting on. And pretty much since the war, they've been pushing hard to try to free the president to conduct kind of hawkish international policy without being encumbered by Congress.
Cheney and Addington started working together in the Reagan administration. And one of the things they worked on together was a report on the Iran-Contra scandal. Cheney was the chief writer on the minority report on that. And Addington helped write the report. He was like a legal aide. What were their conclusions about Iran-Contra?
Most of the world was outraged that Reagan had basically used a kind of secret methods to fund a policy that violated what Congress had wanted. Congress was trying to cut off the secret war in Nicaragua and cut off funding for it, and the Reagan administration figured out a way to fund it secretly. And so while the scandal was really how Reagan had gone behind the back of Congress, that's not how Cheney saw it, not how David Addington saw it. What they saw was that Congress was at fault and that the president should have been allowed to fight the war the way he wanted. They had it was a very unusual view at the time, and not widely shared, but it's a view that I think opens a real insight into their thinking.
When George H.W. Bush appointed Dick Cheney Secretary of Defense, Cheney hired Addington as a special assistant, then promoted him to the position of the Pentagon's general counsel. And then when Cheney moved to the White House, he took Addington with him, I guess first as his general counsel and then as his chief of staff. And you say that Addington created a system that helped make Cheney the most powerful vice president in history. What's the system that Addington helped create to make Cheney so powerful?
Well, a lot of it has to do with, believe it or not, paper flow, which in Washington is so important. It has to do with who knows what. And basically, the way Addington and Cheney set things up, they made sure that every single piece of paper that flowed through the National Security Council in the White House, including even just minor scraps from staff members that were going up to Condi Rice at the time, were also channeled by blind copies through the vice president's office. They made sure also that they were involved in almost all the legal decisions of any importance that had to do with the CIA and with the Defense Department. And so in one way or another, there were people who used to call David Addington the octopus. They couldn't believe that he seemed to have his fingers in everything. And pretty much he had arranged as an expert by then in how Washington works to have all important paper flow through the vice president's office if it had anything to do with national security policy.
How was he able to do that? Did having served in the past as general counsel at the Pentagon help? Did that help him?
Oh, definitely. I mean, because what he, you know, in the Pentagon, he served as among other things, as Cheney's gatekeeper. And he's a real stickler for sort of protocol. And he just made sure that he saw every piece of paper that went up to the boss, to Cheney. And so what you get is, the guy that can decide what decisions get passed on to the boss is the guy that has an awful lot of power. And so he was the spigot, and he took that role again in the White House.
You say that sources told you that David Addington played a key role in a lot of the major documents that set policy for how the Bush administration is conducting the war on terror. What are some of those documents, and what can you tell us about his role?
That's true. People in the administration tell me that he played a very key role in drafting many of these memos and authorizing many of the memos at the very least. And there was a series of them, really pretty, they kind of followed one after another after September 11th. There was a September 25th memo that authorized the president to fight back worldwide against anybody that he deemed to be in any way associated with terrorism. It went way beyond what the Congress had authorized about 2 weeks earlier. After that, there was a memo that came out in November that allowed the government to detain enemy combatants outside of the law in Guantanamo and to try them in tribunals with rules that they pretty much improvised on the spot that were neither following the laws of the Uniform Code of Military Justice nor domestic law. Later on, there, among the most controversial memos, of course, was one that people now refer to as the torture memo that basically allowed the president to sidestep the conventions against torture if he deemed it absolutely necessary. It said that the U.S. government could torture a suspect in terrorism if he felt it was necessary to do so. That and many of these other memos were later amended by other lawyers who came in and said they were too extreme. And as we know, some of these positions were also struck down by the Supreme Court.
My guest is Jane Mayer. Her article on David Addington is in the July 3rd issue of The New Yorker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Jane Mayer. She writes for The New Yorker magazine, and we're talking about her latest article, which is called The Hidden Power, The Legal Mind Behind the White House's War on Terror. The article is about David Addington, who was the vice president's chief of staff and his former legal counsel. There's another document I want to ask you about, and this is an executive order from November 2001. that set up the military commissions. President Bush signed the order, and sources told you that David Addington actually wrote this memo. What was the order and its significance? And this gets to the Supreme Court decision of last week, because that decision challenged this memo.
That's right. Yeah, he and a handful of lawyers wrote it together, apparently, but he was the driving force behind it. What they did was they tried to set up a system of military tribunals that would try the detainees in Guantanamo and elsewhere. Their hope was to try to create a kind of a swift system of justice that would not be bogged down by providing defendants rights the way they are provided under the, American domestic law and under military law. I mean, basically, what they came up with was a process that was very stripped down, and the detainees were not necessarily allowed, for instance, to attend their own trials. They were not necessarily allowed to see the evidence against them. The evidence could be obtained through coercion or torture from others, so that it could have been possibly extorted out of people in situations that might not have gotten to the truth. And in many other ways, it was problematic from the standpoint of defendants' rights in so many different ways that it created there was a furor over it almost from the start. And it wasn't just what the tribunals said, it wasn't just the rules for how they were set up, which were problematical, but it was also the way that the tribunals were created, which was in the hands of a couple lawyers, basically Addington and a few others, without consulting almost any of the other experts in the government or the cabinet members who oversaw the areas of the State Department, the National Security Council. This was really kind of a backroom product.
Yeah, and among the people who you say were not told about this executive order setting up the military commissions was Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, the highest ranking
CIA.
The highest ranking lawyer in the CIA. Nobody in the CIA knew anything about it.
The top lawyer said, called up somebody in the White House and said, "Thanks a lot for telling me." And this person said, "I didn't know either." Nobody, I mean, it was just it's astounding, really, to see how the process worked during these early days after 9/11. It was such a tiny group of people making decisions, and the decisions were so extreme and so unvetted by the experts that really we've wound up with a handful of people making some of the most serious policy decisions in the history of the country. And so that, I think, is what the court has been grappling with still, is were those decisions constitutional? Were the rules they set up constitutional? Were they fair enough? And basically this, last week what happened was the court said no.
Among the people who weren't told that these military commissions were going to be set up for Guantanamo detainees were the JAGs, the Judge Advocate Generals, the top lawyers in the military. Is that unusual that even like the military lawyers wouldn't know about the legal system for dealing with the detainees?
If you talk to the JAGs, they certainly think it's unusual. I mean, they were outraged. There's one I speak to here in the story named Don Guder who talked about it. And when he did, they found out about this, I guess, the weekend before the executive order was announced, and they tried their best to see if they could amend some of the excesses and bring it in line with military law. And they were completely marginalized, he said, and left out. Their recommendations were discarded. And, for the military, I mean, one of the things to me that's so interesting covering these stories is that you think of the military as certainly conservative and certainly not radical or soft or liberal or anything else that you would think of as kind of lefty. Yet among the most persistent and eloquent critics of the Bush administration's terrorism policy have been the military experts, because they're very proud of the fact that we have a very fair and professional military justice system. And it's a system that works not only for the people that we are, holding and trying as, military prisoners of war, but it works, the military feels it protects our own soldiers so that we have the moral high ground. We don't torture people because we want to be able to make the argument our people should not be tortured. So they were very upset that they felt that there were no safeguards being put in place on this, and that what was being set up was something that they would really not want to see U.S. soldiers be subjected to.
Were they concerned that they were being ordered to treat detainees in a way that they didn't want to treat them?
Well, yes. I mean, in both inside the CIA and even more so the FBI, the people who have to be involved in interrogation and who've had experience with it over the years, this is another thing that's interesting, is the people who are interrogators didn't, for the most part, want to push into a territory of brutalization. They didn't want to be in the room brutalizing detainees. And part of the reason they didn't was that they felt it didn't work. A lot of the people who were closest to interrogations say that what works to get real information out of people is much more of a setting up a kind of a personal relationship where you can kind of trade things and wheedle things out of people and get their trust or trick them into trusting you. But brutalization makes people talk, but it doesn't necessarily make them tell the truth. So there was resistance from the field to some of these tactics also.
Well, your sources told you that the CIA, members of the CIA and some of the JAGs were concerned that they weren't getting enough intelligence from the detainees. Now, did they think that was because of the coercive techniques that were being used to interrogate them, or did they think it was because these detainees didn't know anything in the first place?
Well, both. I mean, and that's, I mean, and you bring up there was an interesting anecdote, which was that very early on after Guantanamo was set up, there was kind of growing consternation that the detainees weren't giving up enough information. They've got these guys, you know, incarcerated there, and they're not talking. And so eventually the CIA sent down an Arab-speaking expert who sat down and tried to talk to as many of the detainees as he could, and he came back with really bad news, and he wrote up a report, and what it said was that most of the people in Guantanamo were not people who knew anything. They were sort of all kinds of, there were some people who knew some things, but they were not the super terrorists and the worst of the worst that Donald Rumsfeld had described. And a number of people just were mistakes. They were just the slowest people on the battlefield who'd been captured. And they were, you know, farmers or old people or sick people or, you know, just kind of bystanders, really. There were people for whom there was so little information on some of the people that were held in Guantanamo early on that our government didn't even know their names, let alone have any evidence against them. So this report circulated through the National Security Council, where a number of the people who were following this became very concerned because they didn't want to see the United States government detaining indefinitely in harsh conditions people who were innocent. And so they went to David Addington and Alberto Gonzalez, these people who had concerns, and they said, look at this report. We may have the wrong people there. And what was interesting to me in trying to figure out Addington's role was that he was the loudest person in the room saying, there's no problem. If they're there, they're guilty, basically. If we're detaining them, they're illegal enemy combatants. What's the issue? And, you know, case dismissed. He was not concerned, really, with the situation down in Guantanamo. And part of the reason, again, goes back to his thinking about executive power, which is the president, in his view, has the right to determine that anybody is an enemy combatant. Anybody who's not a U.S. citizen, who could be defined as having anything to do with being an enemy of the United States, could be detained in Guantanamo from his standpoint. And if the president said they were guilty, then they were guilty. So these arguments went round and round, but they got very little traction inside the administration.
One of the things that's confusing to me is that, you know, there's this new expanded definition of executive power that comes, the way you describe it, largely from Vice President Cheney's legal counsel, David Addington. At least he's the legal brains behind it. You know, the vice president is very active in this new expanded definition of executive power. And part of this expanded definition comes from the fact that the president is commander in chief. Okay, but the vice president himself is not part of the military chain of command. So you have this rationale for the president's expanded power as commander in chief, but it seems like it's the vice president and his general counsel, David Addington, that are calling the shots more than the president himself is.
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, it's an irony, really, isn't it? That in order to try to build up the presidency, instead what they did was build up the vice presidency. And, you know, you can actually see there are points where where the vice president and Addington really butt right into the chain of command. There's an anecdote in the story where about a young lawyer in the Defense Department named Matthew Waxman, who was in charge of detainee affairs, and he had the audacity to try to suggest that the Defense Department might want to at least live up to the standards of the Geneva Conventions in terms of humane treatment of prisoners of war. Even if it wasn't, you know, legislated and even if it wasn't mandated, he thought that those standards at least should be the minimal standards for how we treat people. And so he made this argument, and he was upbraided just unceremoniously. He was commanded to show up in David Addington's office, and he was, you know, just berated for his, you know, being out of line and, you know, fighting a war that's not the way the president wanted to fight it. But it wasn't the president who was telling Matthew Waxman this. It was the vice president's lawyer who was telling him this. And exactly why the vice president's lawyer had the ability to summons a senior level person in the Department of Defense is odd, but it tells you a lot about where the power lies in Washington, which is straight in, you know, a straight line into Vice President Cheney's office.
Jane Mayer's profile of David Addington was published in the July 3rd issue of The New Yorker. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Madame Bovary's Ovaries, A Darwinian Look at Literature by David and Nanelle Baroche, and from IFC Films and the Weinstein Company, presenting Wordplay, a look inside the crossword puzzle phenomenon with New York Times crossword editor Will Schwartz and others. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how David Addington got to be very powerful while remaining very hidden. More with reporter Jane Mayer. And Kevin Whitehead reviews the Ben Goldberg Quintet's tribute to Steve Lacy. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about David Addington, who has been described as the legal mind behind the White House's war on terror and its expansion of executive authority to wage that war. Addington is Dick Cheney's chief of staff. Jane Mayer profiled Addington in an article called The Hidden Power, published in the July 3rd issue of The New Yorker. She's a staff writer for the magazine. Let's get back to our interview with her. Has David Addington, the vice president's chief of staff and former legal counsel, did he have an active role, do you know, in the president's approval of the National Security Agency's program on warrantless wiretapping, or in the president's approval of the program to trace international financial transactions?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, it's so interesting because you wouldn't think the vice president's lawyer would have a role in such things. But in fact, he was right there in the room. It was in terms of the National Security Agency's, surveillance, warrantless surveillance. There were a series of meetings. They took place inside Cheney's offices. David Addington was there with a tiny group of top lawyers from the NSA. And Addington, from what I understand from interviewing people, was very persuasive in arguing that the president had no need to try to get warrants, even though that's what the law that had been passed by Congress in 1978 said were required. He argued that in a wartime, the president as commander-in-chief could just sidestep that process of checks and balances and just plain order the surveillance as he saw fit. And the NSA had some concerns, from what I understand, and argued back and pushed back on a couple things that Addington and Cheney wanted to go even further on. But basically, Cheney and Addington won the day, and the program was set up. And in the course of this, they left out one lawyer that I talked to whose job it was at the Pentagon to oversee the NSA. And his name is Richard Schifrin. He's quoted in this story saying that he was just astounded not to be consulted on this. He didn't even know it was going on. He didn't learn about it until he read about it in the newspapers. And that, again, shows you how this tiny group of lawyers, Addington and a handful of people working with him, really determined major policy without consulting the rest of the United States government or many of the experts in the areas that they were making these decisions on.
Now, another area in which David Addington has been a key figure in what's called presidential signings, and these are signings when the president signs a law, he sometimes issues a statement saying that he reserves the right to not comply with aspects of the law that he just signed because he thinks these parts of the law are not constitutional. And in that, it's almost like a line item veto, if I understand it correctly, without being public.
Well, it is like a line item veto, but the problem for the White House is that line item veto was struck down by the court as unconstitutional. So the president didn't have that option. So instead, they kind of created a secret line item veto. It's a process that I can't say that it is only David Addington and this administration that has done it. It's been done over the years before. People say that Sam Alito sort of created the notion of doing this in a kind of a regular way during the Reagan administration when he was in the Justice Department. But what happened in the Bush administration in the hands of Addington, who was a real kind of aficionado of this process, was that they went from handfuls of these signing statements in earlier administrations to what is said to be 750 of these signing statements since the Bush administration has been in power, which is really just a gigantic number of these caveats that have been written into the signing statements by the president. And, you know, it's an area that's so obscure. Most people, didn't notice this. I mean, nobody reads these kind of ceremonial signing statements. It was really only recently that scholars, it began with some political scientists took a look at these things and suddenly realized something strange was going on. And again, it goes back to the office of David Addington. I doubt that he personally writes every single one of these signing statements, but he certainly oversees the process, according to everybody who knows.
From your article, it sounds that in some ways David Addington has had more power and influence than the Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez.
Well, people define Gonzalez, at least in the area of national security law, as not impressive. The other lawyers who were at the table in these small meetings said that Gonzalez would ask questions, but David Addington would answer them and hold forth and really define the policy. And, Gonzalez had a certain amount of juice because he was close with Bush. They go back to Texas when Bush was governor there. But other than that personal relationship, he really was not up on the laws that were involved in many of these war on terrorism issues. And Addington really has been an expert on national security law. He's been involved in it for 20, 25 years. And he has a very retentive memory, and he's very insistent. So he really carried the day on most of these things. And then again, I mean, you really can't talk about Addington without, you know, understanding that he probably would not have been that persuasive if he did not work for Vice President Cheney. But Cheney is so much the power on these national security decisions. People understand that Addington speaks for Cheney on them. And so it's the twosome together that has really made the influence so powerful.
Did you get the impression at all that President Bush intentionally appointed somebody who would be perceived as weak as Attorney General so that Addington and Cheney would have more power?
No, I really think, I mean, that's an interesting, you know, question. I really think in some ways it was an accident of fate. This administration is unusual in having very few lawyers in their most senior positions. If you think about it, the president is not a lawyer. The vice president's not a lawyer. The Secretary of Defense is not a lawyer. The Secretary of State's not a lawyer. The National Security Advisor, when it was Condi Rice, was not a lawyer. So you've got the very powerful cabinet members and top, you know, elected officials are not people who are as conversant with the Constitution as many of the senior people have been in past administrations. And so that kind of leaves a lot of latitude for the people who are the lawyers to interpret it and tell them what they can do. And I think it's another reason that David Addington wound up being so powerful, because he was a lawyer who could tell them how far they could go, and he basically told them they could go as far as they wanted. And there's a critical voice in this story from someone whose name I can't use, but who is was a very top lawyer in the White House, and who basically said, you know, David Addington didn't act like a lawyer here. He acted like an agent to Cheney, because a lawyer sometimes says no. And basically, David Addington always said, yes, you can do anything you want to do.
One other thing that you learned about David Addington is that politically, he really uses hardball tactics. For example, a former top national security lawyer told you, Addington takes a political litmus test of everyone. If you're not sufficiently ideological, he would cut the ground out from under you. Is that a typical comment you heard about his political style?
Yes, he is a tough operator, and he is not beloved. But I have to say, one of the things that made this story hard to do is people are scared of him. And so it was hard to get people to speak out, and certainly especially hard to get people to speak out on the record. That person was on background.
How hard was it to write this article? You said you spoke to about 50 or 60 sources. At the same time, you said a lot of people who have worked with Addington are reluctant to talk about him, either because they're afraid of him or because they want to respect his right to privacy. He doesn't talk to the press. He doesn't allow photos of him. So, you know, the people who like him don't talk about him either.
It was really hard to write this story. I guess, you know, and I'm just sorry that I couldn't get him to talk to me. You know, any time that you're profiling somebody who won't speak to you, it's very hard. And I made many, many efforts to try to get a hold of him. And we ran all the material in the story by the vice president's office in an effort to try to make sure that it was correct. And I called his mother at one point. I spoke with his sister. I spoke with his best friend in high school. I spoke with his high school teacher. I mean, you just kind of go to the ends of the earth to piece together a picture of somebody like this. And, you know, I think it's worth it because to me, it's just very important in a democracy that the public understand who's making the decisions, what their values are, how they make those decisions, and it's just part of the accountability process. I want to connect the dots between the policy and the policymakers. And when you've got somebody who's so secretive and so hidden as this, it's extra hard to do, but it seems to me extra worthwhile doing. And the reason I took a look at David Addington is that from the start, I kept hearing, it's David Addington. It's all David Addington. All these different people kept saying to me, if you really want to know who's in charge, it's David Addington. And I would say, who's David Addington? And, you know, they would say, well, he's the vice president's lawyer. And I'd say, well, what does he have to do with all of this? And they'd say, everything. So, you know, it became very mysterious to me. I mean, some people have described him as kind of the Kaiser Sosa of the administration. He's kind of the secret power behind the throne. And in fact, it you know, the more I reported, the more I could see that his fingerprints were everywhere.
My guest is Jane Mayer. Her article on David Addington was published in the July 3rd issue of The New Yorker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jane Mayer, and she writes for The New Yorker, and her latest article is called The Hidden Power, The Legal Mind Behind the White House's War on Terror, and it's about David Addington, who's Vice President Cheney's chief of staff. David Addington does not want to be a public figure, yet you have this article about him. U.S. News and World Report a couple of weeks ago had a shorter article about him. There was a short piece in the Boston Globe about him. He's becoming a little more exposed. And I'm wondering if you have any read on how that's affecting him?
Well, I don't really, but I have to say that if the Supreme Court's Hamden decision was a rebuke to anyone, it was a rebuke to David Addington. He is the man who's created so many of the policies that the court struck down. So, I mean, far more than the kind of stories that we've written, I would think he would be under a tremendous amount of pressure right now because the courts have completely undermined his position. Now, where we go from here will be interesting. It's hard for me to tell, but my instinct about Addington and Cheney is they don't back down, and they're not going to just fold and say, well, gee, we were wrong. My guess is that they will wage another fight because they've been told they were wrong by lawyers inside this administration and outside this administration almost since September 11th, and it hasn't changed their position.
What is Congress directly going to be called on to decide now in the wake of last week's Supreme Court decision on Guantanamo?
Well, there are a number of areas. I mean, the first is they need to try to come up with some sort of military tribunals that are in line with the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which is a law that Congress passed. It's a code that Congress passed for how military trials are supposed to take place. And, you know, they can try to bring the system that David Addington and others designed is way outside of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It doesn't provide enough safeguards for the defendants. And they can try to amend that system and bring it in line with the UCMJ. That's one thing they can do. Another thing that really is in a way more far-reaching is that the court majority said that that the United States government has to treat detainees of all sorts in the standards of the Geneva Convention, which we're signatory of, and we have not been doing that. The Geneva Conventions require a level of humane treatment that has not been afforded many of the detainees that we are holding. And the government's position, the Bush administration's position, has been we don't need to follow Geneva. And the court said that's not so. So I think the question is going to be how much Congress fights to bring. Will the Bush administration be made to follow the standards of the Geneva Convention, or will they find some way to cut a loophole? Will they just violate the conventions and say it's okay to violate the conventions, or will they make the White House follow the conventions? And, you know, that's a very open question right now. So I'm waiting to see whether the Democrats will speak up about it. So far, the Republicans have pretty much taken a view that the Geneva Convention shouldn't apply, even if the court says they should. There's a problem then because right now, if you follow what the court said, the way the United States government has been treating detainees means that U.S. troops are open to charges of war crimes. And, you know, that one of the things they can do is try to amend the War Crimes Act so that they're no longer violating it, or else they can try to make the U.S. government follow the laws. It's very much up in the air right now.
This is a very tense time between the Bush administration and the press. The president has accused the press of compromising our national security by publishing stories like the NSA warrantless wiretapping story, the monitoring of international financial transactions. Are there any revelations that you've published in The New Yorker that you had to really think twice about before publishing, wondering, could this possibly compromise our national security?
Well, yes, there are. I mean, and in particular, I've published the names, the name of a interrogator who used, he was a CIA interrogator who really was accused of using fairly tortuous methods on a detainee. And I was told by the CIA that it might endanger his life if I published his name. And I would not have published it if I felt that I was outing him in some way, but in fact, I found some promotional brochures that he had put out in a conference that boasted of his role. So I felt it was okay because he was advertising himself that way. But that would have been one of those calls. And then I also published the name of another interrogator for the CIA, a man named Mark Swanner, who interrogated an Iraqi prisoner who died during the interrogation. And I tried very hard to go interview Mark Swanner. I went to his house, and I called him, and I called his lawyer. He has not been charged with murder or with, you know, manslaughter or anything yet. The case has been investigated for years now. And to me, it was a very interesting issue of whether or not the CIA could be held liable for a detainee's death. And you know, I thought long and hard about whether to bring his name into this, and I decided to do it because, again, I think the sort of the fundamental role of the government is that in a democracy is that they need to be held accountable. We don't want faceless bureaucrats doing things that we don't understand. The role of the press is to try to bring information to the public so it can assess what's going on and, you know, vote about it in a democratic way. So it's been a tough time to be a reporter in Washington, though. It's very tense, as you say.
David Remnick, who's the editor of The New Yorker, has a piece in this week's edition about the president and the press. And let me just quote something he says. He says, more than any other White House in history, Bush has tried to starve, mock, weaken, bypass, devalue, intimidate, and deceive the press. I'm wondering if you agree with that and if you think that you have been intentionally deceived or bypassed or mocked by the administration.
Yeah, I thought his commentary was fabulous, and I was really glad to see it in the magazine because I do feel that, of course, that this administration has been harder than any other that I've covered, going back to the Reagan administration, to get information out of. And they basically don't think reporters have a legitimate role to play. So they've made that clear in every way they can.
Well, Jane Mayer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's so great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Jane Mayer's profile of David Addington was published in the July 3rd issue of The New Yorker. Well, let's get in a little music. This is the title track from Dave Burrell's latest CD, Margie Pargie.
Thank you.
Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Ben Goldberg's new CD, paying tribute to the late soprano saxophonist Steve Lacy. This is Fresh Air. Clarinetist Ben Goldberg is a linchpin of the Bay Area improvising scene, where he became known in the early 1990s as a member of the New Klezmer Trio. A few years before that, he'd become friends and studied informally with clarinetist-turned-soprano saxophonist Steve Lacy. Goldberg's new album is a memorial to Lacy, who died 2 years ago. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it shows how well Goldberg understands his subject.
Links by Steve Lacy, as played by the Ben Goldberg Quintet. Goldberg composed all the rest of the music for his quintet's new CD when Lacy was dying in 2004. That album, called The Door, The Hat, The Chair, The Fact, which is on the Cryptogrammophone label, was recorded just days after Lacy passed. Ben Goldberg had set out to compose music in the spirit of his old hero, to the point of writing several variations on the tune we just heard. Song and Dance is the same sort of cuckoo clockwork as a Lacy original. Ben Goldberg's Quintet. To pay tribute to Steve Lacy, Goldberg aimed for an ensemble dynamic similar to Lacy's sextet. Ben's clarinet stands in for Lacy's soprano sax, while tenor saxophonist Rob Suddeth is his brawnier, heavier foil, like Lacy's alto player Steve Potts. Lacy wrote musical settings of poems by 20th century masters like Anna Akhmatova and Robert Creeley. They were sung by Lacy's companion and one-time string player Irene A.B., as he shadowed her on saxophone. In the same spirit, Goldberg gives violinist Carla Kilstead a text to sing and play along with. Fax is Ben's setting of a casual note Lacy faxed him along with some sheet music he'd requested to that tune we heard at the top. It read, "Dear Ben out of town. Probably too late, but here's Blinks anyway. I am hardly here these days."
I am hardly here these days.
Facts, like other pieces on Ben Goldberg's new CD, reflect Steve Lacy's leisurely sense of time. Still, Goldberg knows better than to pay tribute by strict imitation. The actual sound of much of the music isn't so Lacy-like, because, after all, Goldberg has his own band to nurture. Ben Goldberg on clarinet, with Devin Hoff on bass and Chess Smith on drums. Like Steve Lacy or any wise musician who starts out emulating the greats, Goldberg transforms his influences into something personal. In the end, the door, the hat, the chair, the fact, works because he lets his quintet be itself, lets his players find their own balance without looking over their shoulders.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, in stores and online at bn.com. From Capella University, an accredited university offering more than 20 doctoral degree programs online at capella.edu. And from Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. Angie'sList.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
No Child Left Behind, The Death Tax, Axis of Evil. Linguist Jeff Nunberg wants to know why the conservatives get all the good lines. On the next Fresh Air, Nunberg talks about his new book, Talking Right. It's about the language of the left and the right. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.